Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Hafa Sellers-Ross.
And I'm Eleni Jones.
On the show this week, Sean Durkin takes on the Von Erich curse in The Iron Claw. I spoke to Jeannie Finlay and Aubrey Gordon about their powerful new documentary, Your Fat Friend. Steve McQueen returns with an epic documentary, Occupied City, adapted from his wife Bianca Stitzker's book on Amsterdam's Nazi occupation. And I spoke to them both about their film. And on Film Club, it's a return to the wrestling ring in Darren Aronofsky's The Wrestler. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, welcome back to you both. Well, welcome back to Hafa, podcast favourite. How have you been?
I have been good. I've been going from festival to festival this time of the year, looking forward to Berlin coming up around the corner. So it's been an exciting start of 2024, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, and we have a new guest on this week, someone I am very, very excited to talk to. It's Miss Ellen E. Jones, or Mrs. Ellen E. Jones, I suppose. You got married last year.
No, I prefer the Ms., the mysterious Ms. I like to keep people out of the loop on my marital status for old-style feminist reasons. But, I'm a new guest to the podcast, but I was thinking the other day, I believe that I was at the Little White Lies launch party back when Matt Buchensky was the editor. So I'm actually old OG Little White Lies.
We are standing on your shoulders and very grateful for the institution you had some part in. I am really excited to have you on Plucky this week because you've got an amazing new book out.
That's right. Thank you for calling it amazing. I believe it is, but, you know, that's up to the reader to decide. Yeah, it's called Screen Deep, How Film and TV Can Solve Racism and Save the World. And it's kind of a combination of two sort of passionately held beliefs of mine. One is that screen storytelling. Storytelling is the way that, you know, we as humans tell each other about ourselves. And it's the only way we can really change mind because it evokes empathy. And whereas literature can do that too and other kinds of art, screen storytelling in film and TV has a particular power because of the communal way we watch it in the case of cinema, and also just because it's a mass medium in a way that other art forms aren't. And you know, you could say, I suppose social media is a mass medium, but social media doesn't then have that storytelling aspect in the same way. So there's that part. And then the other part of it is this perception that I have that though we all know that we don't want to be racist, really ideas about race and racism are kind of very muddily understood generally. There's a lot of the sort of colloquial understanding of what race and racism is unhelpful. The idea that race is not like a biological certainty, the idea of subcategorizing human beings according to race is nonsense. There's no genetic or biological basis for it, that race is a social construct. That idea is not, I think, as well understood as it needs to be. So the book is all about how we can use film and TV to spread the kind of deeper understanding of race and racism.
And I mean, in your work as, you know, a film critic, a broadcaster, you've got a show on the BBC, but like, have you seen the conversation change when it comes to race in film?
Yes, and in a kind of interesting but incomplete way. So like around 2014, there was, I'm sure you remember, the Oscars So White campaign, and a lot of the conversation has been about diversity, meaning we need to get more black and brown faces into television, more non-white faces onto our screens. and also about representation, you know, the sort of in Michelle Obama's conception, if you can see it, you can be it. It's good for little kids of colour to see themselves represented doing incredible things and being very successful. And I kind of feel that that's just only the very small beginning steps to a truly kind of anti-racist screen culture, which would also involve like making more widespread this deeper understanding of what race and racism and anti-racism really is. You know, often like when Hollywood likes to make films about race, but they're of a very particular kind. They're kind of soothing ones where you have often a white savior character inserted who ends up kind of fighting discrimination in the Deep South during the, you know, Jim Crow era, or who like helps lead an enslaved person to liberty or something like that. So they fulfill this soothing function without actually talking to us about the essential humanity that belongs to all of us, not just white people, and also about how we dismantle the kind of ideas of white supremacy that are quite insidious and pervasive in our culture.
I'm so curious, Ellen, because I was reading a little bit about all of the films and television that you've mentioned in your book. And how did you really funnel what you were talking about? Because it just seems like such a spiraling web of subjects and finding your pool of what you talk about. Did you have like a moment when you first started the book reading saying, this is my connecting thread?
Yeah, I a couple of things. Yeah, I mean, absolutely, it's a huge subject. I definitely bought a bit off more than I could chew in a way. So I had to sort of artificially impose some barriers. One was that I decided that I wasn't going to talk about documentary. I was specifically going to talk about narrative screen storytelling, partly because of this idea of mine that storytelling itself is very important. And then another is that I'm only looking at English language stuff. Like there's a load you could say. Obviously, like European colonialism, it was practiced by not just Britain, you know, it was practiced by other European nations. And therefore, there's loads of kind of art from around the world that could also be a part of this conversation. But because my French isn't much up to scratch and for other reasons, I sort of decided to narrow it there as well. And then also like the decision to make it really about race and racism as a kind of consequence of colonial history means that there's not much in the book about anti-Semitism, for instance, which predates the kind of colonial construct of race, of black, of this kind of black and white binary, or you know, other kinds of racism as well. And like I have had moments where I've thought, it would have been interesting to look at that, but its roots are so different and it manifests so differently in the current screen culture in Hollywood, which let's not forget was basically established by a lot of Jewish blokes from like first generation or second generation European immigrants from New York. So like the way that anti-Semitism manifests in screen culture is very different and kind of maybe needs its own book. But at the same time, like, it would have been nice to include that. So yeah, I had to lay down a lot of artificial lines.
There's enough material for a sequel. Just looking into documentaries or just European films.
Well, the most exciting thing is like, there are lots of filmmakers doing really interesting stuff. Like the barriers to making art are not as interesting as what we do once we're past the barriers, right? And there are like it was necessary to write about a lot of kind of racist films, basically, in order to get to this to the point where I really wanted to be, which is talking about the really exciting filmmakers, mostly of color, but also white filmmakers who are like interestingly investigating and interrogating their own racial identity and racial constructs and racism in the world. And like this, every day there's kind of more stuff that does that with, you know, varying degrees of success. And I'm like, oh, I wish I could have included that in the book. Like Killers of the Flower Moon, I think is a really interesting film from a racial perspective and like interrogating whiteness and indigenous identity, of course. But like that came out a little bit too late for me to include it in the book.
In terms of like, you know, something like Killers of the Flower Moon, or I've recently just been doing a bit of research into films about apartheid, how do you think these things get handled when we're still, you know, these stories about people of colour are in the hands of white filmmakers? Virtually all the apartheid films are.
Yeah, I mean, and this is where the kind of route one conversation about representation meets the sort of more complex areas that I want to get into, which is like, it is necessary to diversify the film industry. It is necessary for people of colour to tell their own stories, to be given the same opportunities that white filmmakers are to tell whatever kind of story they want to, not just one narrow kind of, you know, for instance, for a long time, the only time black women particularly, or really anybody of colour, got recognised at the Academy Awards, it was for playing a very specific kind of role, like the mammy role, or directors of colour might get recognised if they were telling a white story. So Ang Lee is like the first director of colour, I think, to win an Academy Award, I think it's only, and that was for Sense and Sensibility. So that is an issue that has to be conquered. But once we get to a point where there is a bit more opportunity, and we're not quite there yet, I should say, that we still need a lot more opportunity for directors of colour. But then I think we're in an interesting area where you talk about who has the right to tell what stories and what can they do. And the reason I'm a fan of Killers of the Flower Moon is because it seems to me that there's a kind of humble acceptance in Scorsese's filmmaking that what he has to be about is investigating the whiteness, the individual culpability of white Americans in the murder and savagery of colonialism, basically, but also how that manifests in interpersonal relationships, like the romance between, which is a real romance. It's not just a kind of fable for us to explore this abstract idea. But also there's something in the film, in the ending, I don't want to ruin it for anybody who hasn't seen it, but the choice of the way the film ends, which is very unusual. And also in Lily Gladstone's performance, which is very kind of taciturn but knowing, that for me leaves space, is in itself an acknowledgement that these stories still need to be told by Indigenous filmmakers, that there is a limit to what Martin Scorsese can do. And a lot of white filmmaking for a long time has been based on this dangerous and faulty premise that white filmmakers have access to the universality of the human experience and can speak for all the commonality of humanity in a way that people, racialized people, can only speak for their race, you know? So that they just don't, that racialised filmmakers just don't have access to. So I like it for that.
I mean, as a critic, do you think like the opposite has been true for you? Just like, given that you've had such kind of limited representation of like black women on screen, that you've sort of been forced into this kind of role of empathy more so than maybe some of your white male counterparts?
Yeah, but I mean, not just as a critic, as a viewer, I think it's true that people who aren't white men have this vast experience, and I don't see it as being forced into, I see it actually as a real privilege. And what I mean, so just to finish that thought, if you've grown up in a cinema culture or a TV culture where most of the time, most of the really interesting filmmaking that's not like, that's actually exploring the full humanity of the characters is about white men, middle class, straight, able-bodied white men, cis white men, then you're always having lots of experience, not always, but often experiencing stretching your empathy, understanding what connects you to those characters beyond your racial identity or gender identity or whatever else. So you're exercising that empathy muscle much more than the straight white man in the audience is. And I think that is to experience the fullness of the potential of cinema as a, you know, empathy creating machine. And that's a privilege. And I want that privilege for white audiences, white male audiences, or white, you know, whatever the, however we're conceptualizing it as well.
God, yeah. I mean, it's a conversation that I feel like a lot of people don't want to have, but that's such a nice way of framing it, of like, you get the opportunity to step outside yourself.
Yeah, and we deserve the opportunity to see, you know, more direct versions of ourselves represented as well, of course. But like, I think it's important to think about representation in a wider kind of way as well. Yeah. And I mean, part of the like, it's nice that you said just then that it's a lot of people don't want to talk about it, because that's so true. And I think part of the reason for writing a book, and part of the reason I've tried to make it funny and use lots of examples that people will have seen and will love and to just infuse it with passion for film and TV and not make it like a telling people off for watching bad racist movies and enjoying them kind of exercise. I want it to kind of lubricate the conversation, if you like, for people to feel more comfortable about talking about race and, you know, accepting that they might say something a bit dodgy and offend someone, but then they can apologise and learn from that mistake and move forward. And that's the only way we're actually going to move the conversation on and truly be anti-racist in our actions, is if we're actually not unafraid to have the conversation and we can do it.
Well, that's a beautiful point to end on. I mean, it does seem a shame that we're now going into a film, a Lily White movie, but
exercising our empathy muscles once again, though.
Yeah, let's get into The Iron Claw.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
The Iron Claw is the true story of the Von Erich brothers, who made history in the intensely competitive world of professional wrestling in the early 1980s, but faced insurmountable tragedy along the way. Hafa, when we knew that it was the new Zac Efron film, we knew that you'd probably, you know, hunt us down if we didn't get you on to talk about it. Have we been underestimating Mr. Efron all these years?
I feel really bad that Ellen just spoke so beautifully about such important issues and you're like, no, resident Zac Efron girl, coming in. But yes, I have been dangerously obsessed with Zac Efron from a very formative age. High School Musical was very important to my teenagehood years, and I'm still a fierce defender of it to this day. I think if someone told me you can speak to Steven Spielberg or Kenny Ortega, I would have to shamelessly say Kenny Ortega sometimes. But still, I think that at this point, 20 years after High School Musical first came out, oh my god, 18 years since the first one, there has still hasn't been many worthy opportunities for Zac Efron to showcase a wide range of acting abilities that they're not just connected to this idea of a romantic heartthrob or that interweave back into the sort of performative sexuality or the space that he occupied for so long, and really just a role that would define him leaving this idea of youth and teenage heartthrob and into more adult, fully formed roles. Even though he played Ted Bundy quite recently, he still feels like a film that was made to be seen by very young guys in some ways. And I've loved his work in many other films across around the years. I love 17 Again, and I think he's always such a fun presence on the screen. But I've been rooting for a role like this to come to him, and I think he did wonderfully. When I first saw him and those photos of him with that odd shaped hair and the buff muscles and those little tight outfits, for a second I was kind of worried it would come into the dangerous waters of pastiche in a way. But at the same time, I really trust Sean Durkin. Not all of his films have worked for me, but I do think he's a very competent, very skilled director and really able to understand the nuance of human relationships in a way that I don't think many people are being able to navigate the story. So yeah, I think Zac Efron is the beating heart of this film. I think he's truly impressive in his grasp of grief that doesn't fully dilute or kill a notion of a future, and this unrelentless grief. The story, we were just about to go into the film, and I had no idea that this story existed in the world and that it was real and that it had even more grief than the film showcases. I think the notion that Sean Durkin had to cut back on even more loss and death to make this believable for the screen just showcases how utterly devastating the story is. And still, there are moments at the beginning of this film that are so touching and beautiful of brotherly and human connection. I come from a big family, and I think seeing these characters being allowed those moments of happiness and camaraderie are really lovely. But I digress anyway.
Yeah, I was very impressed by it. I didn't know anything about it, really. I don't know much about the world of wrestling or this kind of incredible family of wrestling superstars. Like, Ellen, when you were coming into it, were you a WWE person?
No, I did write a story once about the lady wrestlers of Oxfordshire. So I knew a bit about, like, this kind of contrast between the, you know, the performative aspect of that kind of pro wrestling, ironically called pro wrestling because it is the theatrical aspect of it, but the way that wrestlers themselves very proudly talk up the real athleticism involved as well. And it's a weird kind of mix, and the exact line is kind of a jealously guarded secret, you know, when it spills over into setup and when it's actually a real fight, but which I think the movie deals with quite well. So I knew about that. I didn't know about the Von Erich specifically. I knew Zac Efron could act because I am one of the few people who saw him playing the serial killer Ted Bundy in Extremely Wicked and Shockingly Vile, which is an ethically very questionable film, but it does certainly prove that he can act. And moreover, that he can kind of leverage his sort of teeny bopper heartthrob public persona to add depth to his performance, which I think he's doing here as well. Like when you start that initial shot that you see of him when he's waking up in this incredibly childlike bedroom, you know, in the twin bed next to his brother with sort of I don't know what, but it looks like cartoon characters on his duvet spread. But the contrast of that with this incredibly, almost parodically muscular body, manly grown-up man's body, it sort of encapsulates that kind of Zac Efron persona in one shot, I think. And the physical transformation is very impressive in this movie. But it's more than that. It is a really good performance.
Yeah, I would have put Zac Efron in that category of face that knows what an iPhone is. But I did think he was the sort of period detailing was so, felt kind of so specific, and combined with, I think, the way that Sean Durkin kind of composes, particularly the wrestling scenes, that even the sort of extremities of like 80s styling, like it really worked for me. I mean, one of my notes was Jeremy Allen White haircut is a jump scare, but it felt very like of the time.
I don't know. Maybe this is more of a comment about how good The Nest is, Sean Durkin's previous film with period detail. But for me, that's kind of the one drawback or the one kind of question mark I had about this film is that, and it's so difficult with period films and with biopics, and I've had this conversation about other films I've seen recently as well, but that kind of inherent ridiculousness of the wig wearing and the British actors doing, you know, these good old boy so down home ticks and accents and that kind of thing, like it, for me, occasionally struggled to overcome that, not in Zac Efron's performance notably, and I don't think really in Jeremy Allen White's one, but like maybe it's just because for me the period detailing The Nest was so good that this kind of slightly fell off, but that was a slight drawback for me.
I think it also, it's interesting that you're saying this because at the same time, I just considered it to be an extension of the performance in the ring, that these people are all just performing in their real lives. They have become so intertwined with that idea of having to present themselves to the world as something very specific, that this just seeps in their family life, in the way that they interact with one another. And I knew so little about wrestling. I think, to me, I knew about Lucha Libre. This is the kind of wrestling that I was familiar with, the very Mexican, very Latino kind of wrestling. And when I started reading about the stories that come out of this world, there's so much sorrow that comes from those intertwined lives of performer and real person, and that's an interesting thing to think about, although I was also very distracted by the hair, of course.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting because so much of it is based around this like relationship they have with the sort of domineering patriarch who ranks them just as sort of the industry ranks them, like their worth is never sort of ever disconnected from what's going on in the ring.
I've seen it described as like a comment on toxic masculinity, and you can definitely see that in the father's relationship to his sons, and this whole thing about never let anyone see you crying, but for me, like the Iron Claw itself, which is the wrestling move that the movie takes its title from, is the perfect metaphor for the kind of uselessness of that kind of male bravado. Like I think, as Kevin's character, Zac Efron's character, recognizes from the very beginning of the film, there's a real like sympathy for his father. What his father's trying to do is give them the tools they need to protect themselves in a really hard world that's going to throw all kinds of tragedy and struggle at them, which it absolutely did. And for him, that is wrestling and sort of overt macho-ness and muscle building and being able to look after yourself physically. And yet it doesn't really work because it doesn't protect you. You know, the mum has a similar thing. Like she's equally emotionally repressed, which is why I don't think toxic masculinity kind of sums it up. But her thing is more the church, and that will save you from the, you know, degradations of the world, which again, it doesn't. But like it's all kind of summed up by the Iron Claw, which is this very theatrical move in the ring, but actually does nothing. You know, it doesn't protect you. It's a sort of meaningless thing. It's not a functional coping mechanism to deal with the world and the struggles that are presented. So I kind of think it's not really about toxic masculinity as such, but more the sort of generational trauma and the ways that the sort of horrible tragedy, which is every family's tragedy, I think, which is the very thing that your parents try and teach you to protect you, is often the thing that gets you hurt the most.
And I think that what you're seeing about the parenthood in this film, to me, is the most effective narrative thread of all, because Hope McLennie is so incredible in this as those, that archetypal American dad who wants nothing more than for his children to fulfill his dreams. And it becomes this relationship that is so hard to grasp because there is love, but there's so many expectations. And I think especially with wrestling, which I've learned is very generational. Like you have children that continue on and there's a legacy, really. It's a legacy sport. It just seems like it works as such a wonderful parallel to investigate this notion of Americana that really puts itself into dads that expect their children to be out in the world fulfilling their dreams. And Hope McLennie is absolutely incredible. He's terrifying. His presence is terrifying. You feel his frame fill in the room and you're just, yeah, so gripped by him. Like, I think he's great. And I think him against this certain softness from Zac Efron, the way that he just crunches his shoulders and he makes himself so small, even though he's so big, is really beautiful. I love when they're in scenes together.
Mm. It's the contrast of the dad's kind of gruffness and total lack of any emotional warmth or support or encouragement for his sons with their own support of each other and really loving, encouraging relationship is really effective, isn't it?
Yeah, it is an interesting idea about like how there's so much kind of self-mythologizing going on within their industry and within the ring, but because they've got this sense so early on that we are cursed, that in a way that sort of guarantees their fate. Like they almost all believe that this is going to happen to them, so they might as well not fight it.
I believe in family curses. I think they're real. And it's not superstition. I think it's again this idea of, it's just an acknowledgement of generational trauma and that just recognizing the devastating impact that kind of broken familial bonds or neglectful or emotionally damaged parents who are emotionally damaged themselves like have on their children and on the next generation. That's what a family curse is, really. And I love that one of my favourite aspects of this film is quite subtle, certainly early on, although it really kind of comes to bloom in the final scenes of the film, but this sort of magical realism element. Like, this is a film in which you see ghosts, you know, and I think that's really a really kind of beautiful way of talking about, and the family curse itself is another aspect of that kind of magical realism, of talking about things that actually we all really understand but sometimes don't have the language for or, you know, are confusing. And these kinds of superstitious ideas are quite neat ways of trying to wrap our heads around things that are, you know, like why tragedy would happen.
And in a way, I think this is why the character Lily James is so clever, because it's showing very matter-of-factly that the way to break family curses is to introduce someone who hasn't seen those patterns before and therefore isn't doomed to repeat them. Of course, she's constrained by the entire family and the things that are happening, but the entire time she's just going, oh, you can just not do this. It's as easy as that. What if you don't? Which is interesting.
Well, we should get some scores on this before we move on. Much more to discuss. Hafa, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
I think my anticipation was a solid 4 because I love Zac Efron, as established. And I thought the combination of all the boys of today and Zac coming in together to do a film about wrestling and family was really interesting. Enjoyment, surprisingly enough, this is a film that hasn't fully worked for me in pacing, and I did struggle a little bit with the film itself. So I think enjoyment would be a 3. And in retrospect, also a 3. I think there's incredibly solid performances, and I think its grasp of the family itself and all that we spoke about of generational trauma and guilt is really interesting. But some of the other elements, pacing-wise, I think have not been as effective for me as in other Sean Durkin films like The Nest have been in the past.
Ellen, what about you in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
I think in anticipation of 3, I wasn't particularly eager to see it. I mean, I loved The Nest, but I hadn't really been thinking about Sean Durkin's film much since then. So, you know, I'm not a Zac Efron obsessive. So 3, watching it up to a 4, there were moments, I kind of remained sort of slightly dry-eyed through, let's say, the first third of it, and was sort of wondering why everyone was going on about this movie a little bit. But by the end of it, it really got me, and I really, all the sort of plot threads came together, and I begin to understand this kind of tone of the performances and appreciate it more. So for in enjoyment, and I think for in retrospect too, for the similar reasons.
Yeah, I think I'm probably about the same. Three in anticipation. For some reason, I thought I was going to go see a kind of heartwarming sports underdog movie, which, you know, because it's something about the timing of the release felt like, oh, this is the sort of feel-good fare that, like, might do well in awards season or something. So, yeah, I four in enjoyment, four in retrospect. I was pretty floored by it. I spent hours afterwards reading absolutely everything about the real life cases. And yeah, I then rewatched it knowing everything about them and knowing exactly what was going to happen. And I think it works with really well with kind of both levels of knowledge coming into it. Next up, I got to chat with director Jeannie Findlay and the subject of her documentary, the wonderful writer and podcasting icon, Aubrey Gordon.
We need to go.
It's a joy to meet you. And it's also like, frankly, given the media landscape around fat stuff, I would much rather talk to someone who's familiar with the work than someone who is not and is like predisposed to be resistant or rejecting of it, right? Like it feels like there's a pathway in when someone's like, I've heard a little bit about this, right? You've sort of got a foothold in the conversation. So
I was reading your work when you were like anonymous, just as signing things off as like your fat friend, but I'm wondering, when did you become first aware of Aubrey's work?
So I was one of the people that read her first article, and I'd already been making a film about fatness for about a year, and you know, I'd been doing a bunch of research, and so I sort of figured, yeah, I can do an essay doc. I'm going to be the female Adam Curtis, and so I was going to make an essay doc about fatness, and I started doing research, looking at clothing and whatever, and then I sort of realised, hey, I don't want to make it about this. I want to make it about politics. And anyway, I was one of those people that read Aubrey's piece in the first week. And then I think we started talking quite quickly after that. And initially, I asked Aubrey to write the voiceover. So Aubrey was going to write the voiceover for this essay film. And then I went out to Portland, filmed with Aubrey. And there was this sort of big disconnect between this very intimate and emotional inside voice that's her writing, and then also the full-throated, big-laughing person that I met in Aubrey Gordon, not your fat friend. And I thought, oh, this is really interesting. And then when I met Aubrey's family and they were struggling to say the word fat, I was like, oh, yeah. Because I'm always looking for the gap in, if I'm making a film, where's it going to go? You know, and I was sort of kidding myself in making an essay film. I mean, who was I kidding? I like making films about the messy stuff of families and how that plays out in real life. You know, like in Seahorse, Freddie McConnell's a trans guy wanting to have a baby. What's that like in his life with his mum? What does it mean to get pregnant? So when I met Aubrey, it was like, oh yeah, what's this like for her? As a person in the world.
I absolutely adore Seahorse. I mean, with like, you know, you're putting a huge amount of trust to kind of with your story. Was seeing Seahorse something that kind of like helped you make that decision?
Absolutely, no question. I think particularly as someone who had done a lot of organizing with trans communities, there are so many pitfalls for those stories to fall into. And it felt really incredibly meaningful that that film so gracefully sort of skated through all of the potential pitfalls and really, really, really centered the sort of human people at the center of the story. I would also say watching The Great Hip Hop Hoax, which could absolutely have been a very sensationalized story, watching Orion, The Man Who Would Be King, which also could have been a very sensationalized story, and seeing how Jeannie's choices allowed their stories to breathe and to be a little more human and a little less like, get a load of these guys, can you believe it? Right? Which would be very easy to do. And it felt really meaningful to see stuff like that play out in a way that felt like it held a whole lot more nuance, a whole lot more tenderness. And in that way, felt like very related to the writing I was doing at the time, right? Like, it felt like there was sort of an alignment between Jeannie's voice as a filmmaker and my voice as a writer in a really nice way.
Yeah, when I read that first piece, I was just like, oh, here's someone who's making their personal political and they're putting themselves into this. And I really felt an emotional connection in a way that I hadn't in any... Like, I'd filmed a bunch of plus-size bloggers, But it was too clothing is too distracting. Mm. I'm interested in what role does bias play in the way that we understand our fellow humans? How does that play out in doctors' offices? How does that play out in the meaningful relationships in our life? And I sort of wasn't getting that when I was talking to people about clothing. Mm-hmm. And so this was an opportunity to go a bit deeper. And also, you know, anonymity. I made the Orion's about a guy who wears a mask, so obviously I was all in.
Yeah, you're like a masked performer.
Yeah, I mean, like, sort of, we're sort of starting the film in a place where you're in relative anonymity, and then, you know, of course, it's the podcast, but also your book deal, and then now it's like fully the document. I mean, like, what's that process been like for you? I mean, harrowing, I'm sure. How has it been like becoming more and more the kind of public face of the thing of your words?
Yeah, I think there's like a fair amount of like emotional whiplash with it, particularly as a fat woman in her late 30s, now 40. Previously, when people would look at me or stare at me on the street, that meant that they were about to say or do something horrific, right? That meant that they were going to take my picture and post it on the internet to make fun of it, or that they were going to say something horrible to me, or that they were going to recommend a weight loss surgeon. Just like a stranger on the street came up to me and was like, there's a weight loss clinic right up the road. Like, no hello, no nothing, right?
Like, buy me a drink.
What's your name?
I hope they're having a horrible day.
Yeah, totally. But like, to go from that to, wait a minute, this person might be looking at me because they know who I am, or they've seen my work or whatever, I feel like my nervous system is still catching up to that. Like, people noticing me in my physical body is not necessarily like a sign of bad things, right? That feels like the biggest emotional growth spurt that's happening for me at the moment.
And working with each other, I mean, is there much in terms of a like divide over the Atlantic in terms of the way these like anti-fat biases like come up? Or, you know, obviously healthcare is very different on either side of these things, but they seem very similar to me.
I think bias shows up in personal relationships in very similar ways. But I would say that the size level that bias and just terrible behaviour kicks in the UK is a lot lower. So you're going to hear a lot of terrible, you know, I'm a small fat lady. Mm. And by that, I'm describing myself as a fat lady, but I'm recognising that there's privilege attached to the fact that I do not get the same drama from doctors. I mean, I get my fair share of drama. They get the big plate out and they they start describing what a protein is. It's like, you guys, I'm not a dummy.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar. Could you go into a little more depth?
Explain what a diet, you said.
Pardon me, a carbohydrate?
You know, so I think that the size that kicks in the UK is a lot lower. Mm. But, you know, it's just variations on a theme.
Yeah, I mean, I think you all are lapping us in terms of access to healthcare, as is known to you all and the whole wide world.
Yeah, we got other problems.
And at the same time, I think anti-fatness shows up in healthcare in a great deal of ways. I mean, I think the one that I very frequently think of is Boris Johnson getting diagnosed with COVID and saying, the answer to this is not for everyone to wear a mask. The answer for this is for everyone to take 1 to 5 years to lose weight. Is our COVID prevention strategy, right? Like, the math on that does not add up. So it just feels like it has seeped into, in many, many, many places, certainly the US and certainly the UK, it has seeped into our interpersonal relationships, it has seeped into our healthcare provision, it has seeped into our policy, it has seeped into our media representation, right? That, like, at almost every turn, we are telling fat people that they are lesser than, that they don't deserve services, and they don't get access to those things unless and until they lose weight, which we know is nigh on impossible for most of us, right? According to the National Institutes of Health in the United States, someone my size has a 0.8% chance of attaining their BMI recommended weight in their lifetime. So assuming that there is a 99.2% chance that I stay this size, then what? Then what do we want to do with that, right? If we stop haranguing people to do something that we know is not fully possible, then what changes in our perspective about this? And that feels much more interesting to me, is just assuming that fat people are here and will continue to be here. What do we do with that rather than going, we gotta make them all thin, right? Like, what else does that look like?
What does our present tense look like instead of this sort of fantasy future land?
One of the moments of the, it's just a small moment, but you're talking to Michael Hobbs and he says something along the lines of like that his expertise is taken a little bit more seriously than yours almost. It's just like, you know, that it's like, it's almost like the skinny person has to be considered to be the objective expert. Has that been like the case at all with like making the film for you, where it's just like assumed that you don't have a clear-eyed view on this, even though you have like the most incredible stats and science to back up everything you say?
You know, I mean, it's an anxiety for me that people won't take the film seriously. But then I remember that this is my 9th feature film. It's not my first time at the rodeo, so fuck them.
You know what I mean? God, put that on a t-shirt.
That's right.
I mean, your profile's like risen, of course, across like not just the journey the film covers, but like since. Like, do you feel that your expertise is being taken more seriously nowadays?
I would say yes, and there is always a ceiling to that for a fat person talking about fat stuff, right? That a thin person saying the same thing will be applauded until the end of time, right? Like, for their courage in saying so. And a fat person saying very similar things will receive death threats and will receive, like, incredible sort of blowback for, again, like, doing and saying the same things as thinner people might do or say about fatness. So that feels like it is ever present, that there are definitely people who approach me and my work as, you're just telling yourself a story to make yourself feel better, I think is sort of the narrative that folks have. And I can't change that for folks. It feels like work that you can really only come to, any kind of fat justice or liberation work, is work that you can only come to when you're ready to get there, and nobody can make you be comfortable with the word fat, or make you be comfortable spending time around fat folks, or make you feel more comfortable in your own body image, or any of that sort of stuff, right? Like, that is all internally driven, and until folks are in a place where they're open to hear it, they might hear it from thin people, but they're definitely not going to hear it from fat people, unfortunately.
I mean, I would say that, like, just speaking to both friends that are familiar with your work, and then also after the screening, because I saw this for the first time at Edinburgh, I do feel that you are changing things. I think a lot of people that I speak to feel like they feel very transformed about their relationships with their bodies and you know, the way that they're viewed in the world by this. And the thing I've heard a million times is just like, I just wish I'd watched this or listened to this or read this when I was a teenager.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's wonderful to hear. That's totally wonderful to hear.
Yeah, I'm sure you've had that before.
Sure. And also, I think, you know, resistance on this topic runs deep, you know, and I think every single one of us has many, many layers of this stuff to work through, right? Your own internal body image is one part of it. Accessing the healthcare and services that you need is another part of it. How you treat people who are fatter than you, regardless of your size, is another part of it, right? Like, so it feels like sort of no matter who we are, we'll have resistance in one or more of those places, right? And for folks who have worked through their resistance in one or more of those places, those seem like the folks who are like, oh, right, I really am unsatisfied with my body image. I really am unsatisfied with how I've been told to feel about my body. Maybe I could go down this road, right? Those feel like the folks who are like coming along, and that feels extremely exciting.
I think something I think about as well is there's a bit in the film towards the end where Aubrey says, I get all these messages from people all the time asking me, how do I cope with this? How do I do this? How do I fix my body image or whatever? And she says, I don't know, I'm in it too. And I think about that, and I think about the tenderness in that moment for me in the film, and it makes me sort of feel like, yeah, it's okay, we're all works in progress. And I think it's okay to say, I'm just figuring this out. Yeah. But for myself, speaking personally, what I want more than anything is to live in the present tense. You know, I don't weigh myself anymore. And that's been a whole journey through making the film as my politics have sharpened. It just feels stupid. Why would I do that? You know, and I started powerlifting last year. But when I engaged the trainer, I said, I don't want to discuss my weight. I want to be strong. And so the focus is like, how much can I lift? What's that feel like? Rather than having a discussion about how much do I weigh? So I felt very clear-eyed going into that relationship, and I set the boundaries of that. And I can see people around me starting to do stuff like that. It's those little incremental things where you set the boundaries of, like, this is the discussion we're having.
We also talked about this at the time when you started lifting, and you were like, fat people are strong.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, man, every time I stand up, that's a 300-pound leg press. Do you know what I mean? Like, we are carrying around a whole lot more. And I think that that sort of strength gets underestimated, including by fat people, for sure.
It feels really fucking good, though. Mm-hmm. There's something really heavy above my head.
There was an Olympic weightlifter from the U.S. I believe her name was Holly Mangold, who is about my size and was in the Olympics and I believe medaled in the Olympics. And the media around her win was not, yay, look who won the Olympics. It was, we're really worried about her health. And I'm like,
oh my God.
A literal Olympic athlete team. Like, I don't really know what else we need here, except I totally do, right? Except it's, like, totally obvious.
It's like, here's my life's work. Yeah,
absolutely. But it is a really, really tricky thing. And I think you're right. It plays out very differently for women and for men. There's still plenty, plenty for men to contend with. Mm-hmm. There is more for trans people of any gender than for cis people of any gender. Like, it's through the roof for trans people. But, like, yeah, I think you're right.
So, you know, this is a film podcast. This is a brilliant film. Like, in terms of, like, cinema itself and documentaries and film, like, where do you think representation needs to go in that direction? Because I watched Wonka a couple of weeks ago and I thought it was delightful. And, like, when they brought out the fat suit, like, my heart just, like, goes into my shoes. I can't believe we're still doing it. What would you like to see less of and more of?
I mean, I share your views on Wonka. I almost put Paddington 2 in my top 10 for the BFI for the Sight and Sound.
I was close to
top 10. It was probably about number 12. But I was so excited to see Wonka. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Roald Dahl, he's a special case in terms of the way that he treats people. But, like, with the fat suit, I was like, come on, guys. Mm. This is so tiresome. And I saw a really disappointing interview with Olivia Colman where she was saying, I'm playing an evil character, so I get to wear a lovely fat suit, nice and evil, nice and fat. And I think what I'd like to see is evil and fat not automatically being synonymous with each other, because it's just so boring. But what I would say is Divine Joy Randolph is, what a great name, because she is a joy to watch in absolutely everything. She's fully present tense. She never feels like a doer-upper, a project. Mm-hmm. She's just herself. She takes up space and she's a magnificent actress. Mm-hmm. I just want to watch her in everything. So I want to see more people where they're just living their lives rather than the fat sidelined character, the fat funny character. I want to see more not despicable, but I want to see, in the same way with queer representation, you just don't want it to be one way. I want a whole sort of breadth of fat representation. Yeah, let's just see all different kinds of fat people, not just tokens or evil characters.
Yeah, I would say there is almost no reason to use a fat suit in a film. The reasons to use a fat suit in a film are because you are telling stories that fat people would not tell about themselves, right? Because you need a thin person to dress up as a fat person in order to tell it. I think in terms of where fat representation is moving, I was in high school and college when, like, Norbit and Shallow Hal and the many sort of, like, Farrelly Brothers, Eddie Murphy, like, fat suit sort of comedies came around. At the time, they were big hits. People today think of them as relatively tasteless, but at the same time, they give The Whale an Oscar, which is straightforwardly imagined body horror of what it would mean to be a fat person without the participation of anyone the size of that character in that film, right? So it feels like I would love to be able to say fat representation is moving in a solidly good direction. But I'm like, I don't know, it used to be blockbuster comedies and now it's an Oscar-winning film. It feels like it's being sort of prestigified rather than rejected wholesale. And I would really, really like to see folks stand up for, what does it mean to let fat folks tell our own stories? What does it mean to cast fat people in fat roles? Like, what would all of that look like? I mean, I think famously Darren Aronofsky said, well, we thought about casting a fat person, but they couldn't physically have done it. And I was like, the movie is sitting on a couch. what could they not have done?
Right, like... I think they were like, we shot it in 28 days or something. Yeah. Like,
yes. So I would just love to see folks pushing back more on that kind of very facile thinking. That if you spend 5 to 10 seconds with it, you're like, wait a minute. Hang on a second. it feels like, you know, there are real bright spots of fat folks doing incredible work. I think much of that is in comedy. I think Nicole Byer is a gift to the world. I think Sophie Hagen is a joy on this planet. Mm-hmm. There are so many folks who are sort of doing that work mostly as stand-ups or solo storytellers because it can be so hard to sort of move up the ladder with a fat story about fat people. I mean, just... as an author, the number of people that I sent book proposals to who would write back and say things like, it's really well written. Could we do it without saying fat? Like, could we write this book without you using the word fat? And I was like, why would we do that? And who would that be for? Right? Mm-hmm. Like, that kind of stuff is ever present. Mm-hmm. And I think folks who are not fat have a greater sense of like ebb and flow of that than folks who are fat who are like, nope. Going to the doctor still stinks. Right? Like, nope, I'm still watching fat suits and movies. Right? All of that sort of stuff feels like we got a ways to go.
We do. I'm hopeful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you both so much.
Your Fat Friend is now out in cinemas.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The past collides with our precarious present in Steve McQueen's Occupied City, adapted from the book Atlas of an Occupied City, Amsterdam 1940 to 1945, written by Bianca Stidger. McQueen's documentary creates two interlocking portraits, a door-to-door excavation of Nazi occupation that still haunts his adopted city, and a vivid journey through the last years of the pandemic and protest. Before we get into the film, I spoke to Steve McQueen and Bianca Stidger about their film. Worth noting that several of McQueen's artworks are referenced throughout, so if you don't know what Year 3, Ashes, and Grenfell are, it's worth giving them a quick Google.
Personally, for me, it's huge thing, you know, being from an occupied city. How do you feel like cities are transformed by occupation? Because something like, I'm thinking, you know, like Mangrove, you can see the literal craters of what has been left over from the war. But like Amsterdam has a very different relationship with how that period has played out. Like, how do you feel like it was transformed by its occupation?
Well, obviously, a very large part of the population was murdered. Mm-hmm. So there were whole streets where all the houses stood empty. And that even happened more, that the houses of people who were deported, Jewish people who were deported, were then stripped of their wood for people to burn in their stoves during the hunger winter. So a lot of those houses after the war. Then the city government decided not to rebuild them. So, you know, the whole fabric of the city was affected in that sense. There's now, for instance, you still see parts of Amsterdam where there's a kind of very broad alley, almost a boulevard or highway right through the city center. And then if you know, then you know why that happened.
Mm-hmm.
That is a result of what happened in the war. But of course, let's say in the years just after war, people know that. But that kind of knowledge, of course, the longer it is ago, the more people will not know why that street, why suddenly there is such a wide street in the middle of the center. So in that sense, yes, it affects it. But a lot of those effects are then, the reason behind them are forgotten.
And like, you grew up in the city, you're coming to it, you know, a little bit later in life as somebody that moved to Amsterdam. Do you think that that was more striking in some ways for you? Like the way that, like, the occupation had, like, made its mark on this place?
Very. It was very. I think that's the first thing that got me into thinking about a project, just because of the invisibility, but the actual presence. You could feel the presence, you could smell the presence, but you couldn't see the presence. And somehow I wanted to visualize that through a camera using film. I think that was very much the reason why I wanted to make the film.
There's this incredible ambition with it, where both in the book and then, you know, now in the film, where you're looking at so many different people, so many different stories, you're kind of, you know, surveying this, like, entire city. Conceptually, what was important about kind of almost not leaving any story left behind, like, to actually pick up on every single one of them?
Well, I think the book is very different from the film. I think the book is encyclopedic, mm-hmm. in a way. But there's a certain kind of a poeticness to that nature of it. It's not just sort of, you know, it's not just sort of bombarding you, but it's giving you a structure in a way. And I think the film, what I attempted to do with the film is to give the viewer the weight of it. Some things you'll be able to take in, other things you would just look at the images and rather than listening to the dialogue. But that overwhelmingness is just like going to a classical concert,
mm-hmm.
where you bring yourself to a situation where you can never hold on to all of it. But this is why it was a hand in glove situation for this particular subject matter, because as bankers, I said often, the more you know, the less you know. You can't hold all of it in your head, but that's part of the sort of experience of it, because it's not a history lesson, it's a meditation. You are allowed to sort of, you know, hold on to sort of an image rather than what the person's saying, or hold on to some a memory in your head. But because what it does is a picture provokes so many things emotionally.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that 130 addresses that are in the film, there are many more, and I think the film conveys somehow that this is just the top of the iceberg, basically, but that everywhere the camera roams, there is another story waiting in the wings.
And it's important to say I shot and edited all 2,000 addresses,
mm-hmm.
but we edited the feature film down to 130, and then I'll do something else with those 2,000 addresses later.
Yeah, I mean, there's been talk of this, like, 36-hour cut, film.
Yeah.
I mean, where did you make the decision as to the ones that would? And were there any particular stories that you...
I think it's a very formal thing. Certain things are repeated, certain things are very similar, and the things are one... You know, sometimes you have to put certain things in which work for the feature film in that 4-hour feature film better than it would do it in other places. And there's certain things you have to sort of leave behind because not everything can fit in the feature film.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a case of time limit, but at the same time, you want to push beyond a moment to break into something else. So again, it's about sort of, you know, we were lucky to have the opportunity to have the choice. That's what made the film, because we had everything.
That because you filmed everything, yes. There was a wealth of material, yes. to choose from that would never have happened if you only filmed the 130 addresses you started with. Then it would have been not as rich film, I think.
I absolutely adored the film, but like previously talking to you, you mentioned this incredible story about the guy that goes and picks, I think, cherries or strawberries. and like that seems to me to be such a incredible document of like the passive person who doesn't stand up in the face of evil, the person that we all wish that we wouldn't be.
Like, but in the time, you know, we don't know if we'd be that person.
Mm-hmm. That's no, the thing. You can't know.
You can't know. I mean, in everyone retrospective, okay, oh, sugar, I would have done that, I should have done that. But there aren't too many people putting their hands up saying to us, you know, the mother or father or member of the Nazi party right now.
Well, I guess it's that difficult thing because I think maybe something like 12 Years a Slave, there, people take comfort in being like they would be the kind slave master like a Benedict Cumberbatch and not appreciate that that's actually kind of the worst person that you could possibly be.
Exactly. If that may be about that, that's for sure.
One would hope that when you watch the movie, that's the kind of thoughts that go through your head because it's the images are of now, when you hear the stories, it makes it somehow easier to imagine, hey, these people on the screen and the people from the past, they are the same. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I am the same too. It becomes like a mirror.
Do you then feel that, like, also you end up having this, like, profound, like, responsibility for the people of the past? Because I'm just thinking, like, you know, David Kurtz in 3 Minutes, or, you know, like, Solomon Northrup, or, you know, even, you know, the stuff of, like, Mangrove or Grenfell or something. Like, do you feel a weight with your work in terms of,
I want,
like,
the weight. I want the responsibility. Yeah. I always look for it. I don't know why. I've always looked for that. Always look for responsibility. I always wanted that load, for sure. Put it on my shoulders. I always wanted it. Mm-hmm. Always. Never feared it.
For me, when I was doing the research, the most difficult thing was when I couldn't find any information about someone except that he was born and murdered for being Jewish. And I couldn't find, so you can't keep someone even in a work of a memorial. You only have a name, so that was the thing that made it was very hard for me to accept.
So do you then view yourself as being part of, like, not letting that exist? Like, you won't just let people be a number. Like, you are actually going to make them...
That was one of the absolutely the things that you can try to make this abstract number of 6 million people murdered, make people realize that it was... They were all individuals, men, women, children from all types and kinds, and not one abstract number, but each a person.
At what point did you kind of identify, like, the cinematic potential of this? Because I mean, you both worked across, like, different forms, different mediums. Like, at what point did this seem to be something that should exist?
It happened at different points, because Bangers, you know, she was working on books, 2005, and for me, obviously, as a visual person, I was thinking about something else. I mean, again, we weren't even thinking of the same thing. We're thinking of two different things completely. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of the past and the present. I was thinking, okay, what happened if I had to get some footage from 1940 and follow the camera identically to that footage so you can reinforce the buildings? Because it's a 17th century city, so basically the buildings would be reinforced, but at the same time, you have the living and the dead walking into the same frame. I thought, oh, that would be amazing. You know, to sort of, somehow I wanted, as I said before, amplify visually, but as well, I want to amplify audially and visualize the past in the present. But then next door, I kept on hearing these sort of keys tapping, you know, Banger's tapping his keys. I thought, maybe the past is text and the present is the present. So you could put the two together, and that was it. So two things happening in the same house but different locations, and this sort of, oh, you can put the two together. I told Bianca.
Yeah, and I was first, of course, surprised because this book, when you see it, is one of the least likely books to ever be made into a film. That was surprising, but I immediately thought that could be a wonderful idea and a very new approach to having a film about history.
I mean, is it often the case that hearing each other tapping away, but, like, do you consult each other a little bit about kind of, like, the work that you're doing?
For sure.
Always in conversation.
I mean, who else am I going to talk to?
I'll give you my number, you can call me.
When it comes to the locations in the city, like, this is a place that you know, like, made your home. I mean, you know, growing up, obviously living there, but now as a, I guess, a proud Amsterdamian, or I'm not sure what the term is, but, like, were there any locations that were, like, particularly personal to you that then you had to kind of have these difficult accounts of what happened there?
Not particularly difficult accounts, but they were personal because, like, Alex's school.
Yeah, our children, the school careers of our children, you can see how intertwined were the Second World War still is with nowadays location. And our daughter went to a school that was a school building that was taken by the Germans to put the headquarters of their secret police, or the Gestapo, and so on, was located there. This was where people were interrogated and tortured.
Within the school?
In that school building. So they put the school children in another building, and they just took that building to use it for this purpose. And after the war, it became a school again. And our daughter had a nice, happy school life.
But these are they were in classrooms where people were tortured and interrogated. Yeah. And at the same time, now there was that room is about learning and having fun.
Nice, yeah. And our son, the school our son goes to now was one of the prisons of Amsterdam, where the same kind of things happened. So
his former school was a Jewish school.
Was a Jewish school before the war, and then during the war they created a system that all Jewish children had to go to special Jewish schools. They weren't allowed to mingle with the other children. So that also happened in his school, so you can see. And then even his kindergarten was in a place where the Amsterdam police battalion was located, that was a part of rounding up Jews before they were sent to the camps. So
you can see within that every day,
all the schools of our children were buildings, so
it's unavoidable.
Yeah.
And is that something that you were aware of beforehand? I mean, is that kind of like part of the living history of, like, we understand that that's a space?
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe not for everyone, but there's a plaque in the entrance of the school.
Yeah. Well, if you want to know, you know. If you don't want to know, you don't know. I mean, that's just how it is. Yeah. People don't bother with it, so other people do.
Yeah, because I remember the two of you told me that, like, when you went to Solomon Northrop's, the place there that's very much like an erased bit of history. Like,
totally. We actually campaigned to get a plaque.
Yes.
On the building where the slave pen was, which is now, I think it's U.S. military Air Force
aviation.
It's kind of an aviation building, and also the hotel that he was kidnapped. Mm-hmm. The building is still there, but the location that we know where location was, which is the aviation building now, which is the building's not there, but the building where someone was kidnapped in, the hotel is still there, but we try to get a plaque on.
And in Amsterdam, for instance, the buildings where the, except for that building, but a lot of buildings where the Germans were, that is a thing that is forgotten very quickly because no one will put a memorial for them. So those kind of locations, very feared during the war, are kind of like that goes out of active knowledge, let's say.
We're kind of shifting in terms of history, where we're kind of going out of living memory for this.
Yes.
And, like, you know, it is a big move to go from something that's living memory into what's documented. Mm-hmm. So do you kind of view this as being beyond an astonishing film, something that is actually a significant part of keeping, like, what actually happened alive?
You know, in a way, I would say yes, because also in the voiceover for that reason, I put a lot of direct quotes from survivors and other people that lived during that time. So yes, it's very important, I think, to keep that knowledge active somewhere.
And also with Melanie, the lady with the voiceover, this was a young Jewish woman who's living the text in a, you know, not in an unmanipulative way. She's not dictating. She's not an authority. Sure, she is. As Bianca said before in the interview, which is beautiful, she said, she's sharing this knowledge. She knows as much as you, and she says it, she finds out, and you share this knowledge together.
She's just one step in front of you on this walk through Amsterdam. Yeah.
I love that. Just so beautiful. So it's very emotional, not because, I can't even say that because I don't want to say it's emotional. No, but the responsibility is given to the viewer to take on the emotions of what she's saying.
Yeah, so I think, and for that reason, it's written very factual, exactly. And it's spoken.
No one wants to manipulate anybody. Yeah. I'm not interested. But here's the information.
Facts speak for themselves.
Yes, but what's optimistic about it is it's of a woman, a Jewish woman, who is of the now, you know, not of the then. There's a future.
The funny thing is, I actually found myself thinking a lot about Year Three when I was watching it the second time, where it's like this idea of a future or not a future, because Year Three to me seems to be so much about like speaking to this like beautiful future, and then you're watching almost the same scale of people robbed of it.
Very interesting
thoughts. Oh my God, I'll use that. Yeah. I'll quote you from that. But it's interesting because in some ways, and it's a future that a lot of people don't want to see, don't want to put their eyes, because, and then when you see the future of London, it's black and brown. But they don't want to see that. If it's a future, I think what happened in Year Three is the first time the future of London has been visually seen. I don't think there's ever been a situation where people have had the opportunity to visually see the future of London. And there it was. There's 75% of the schools in London and on those walls. And with the future, you know, a lot of people didn't like seeing this. It's, you know, it's black and brown. That's how it is. Don't like it, but there you go.
Wow. I'm wondering, like, introducing meeting Stephen, like bringing him over to Amsterdam, where you've sort of lived with this occupation your entire life, how was it kind of explaining what it was to live in a place that's constantly filled with like memorials of like, oh, this is the statue, this is where somebody was shot, this is where they rounded up people and stuff. And like, did you kind of feel that you tapped into like a sort of lingering shame around Amsterdam's occupation?
Well, I think for most people, maybe not, because you can pass a monument on your way to work or to school 200 times and still don't know what it is about. It can be, it's like a tree or a stoplight or something like that. But I think for Steve, talking about this with someone from somewhere else gives, of course, a fresh perspective. And then you realize, this is actually kind of remarkable or strange. So you look at it with fresh eyes, absolutely.
Like, you know, as a black woman in this field, I think I'm, like, hyper-aware of, like...
When you say black woman in this field, put us in the interview, I hope so.
Of course.
Excellent, fantastic. Little white lies, there you go.
but I'm hyper-aware of, like, the messed-up questions that black artists get asked and that women get asked. And I'm just wondering whether on this press tour there's been anything that you've been maybe disheartened by because of like the line of questionings that you've endured, because it does feel that like you're experts in your field, you're acclaimed in your field, but like there's often kind of like undermining questions that get asked that I try not to do that, but
I never got one.
It could have been worse, probably.
It could have been.
No, there hasn't.
Do you think that's generally happened to you? The way you've kind of like maybe like had.
Well, the worst one I was on was Widows. That was pretty bad. I mean, that, you know, some of the questions that were asked to the cast by these male journalists were pretty obvious, quite sexist.
Mm.
And I was very, and some of the reviews, I couldn't believe what some people had said. And it's like, wow, but that was very, you know, that was very illuminating, to say the least.
Well, I think in the book, I tried, for instance, to get women, for instance, that were in the resistance or female voices a bit to the forefront, and I think we tried the same in the film. But
we've been very fortunate in this case. I mean, it's been great. I think we respect the people for 3 minutes as well, so therefore coming into this has not been a question.
No.
Oh, God, that's wonderful to hear.
So, Ellen, Steve McQueen, one of my favourite ever filmmakers, artists, human beings that has ever lived. You came into this, I assume, a bit of a fan?
Oh, yeah. I would also say he's one of my favourites. But I didn't really know what to expect from this, because my favourite Steve McQueen films are Small Axe, which is obviously an anthology, maybe an anthology of TV programs, but let's call it a film, and Widows, which is mainly because I'm a fan of the crime genre, and he doesn't really tie himself to genre in any way, but I just was happy that there was a collision of a favourite filmmaker and a favourite genre. So being that this is kind of very different from all of those, it's not set in London, which is one of the big things I liked about Small Axe, that it felt kind of germane to me and my family's experience. And it's not, you know, a genre piece. I guess I didn't really know whether I would love it as much as I did.
And did you know much of Bianca Sticker's work? Did you see 3 Minutes of Lengthening?
I did see 3 Minutes of Lengthening and liked it a lot, and really thought it was interesting the kind of way she was playing with, not even playing, that's too light a word, but exploring duration of the kind of the clip, the material, which is from, it's basically based on some home film footage that a family took when visiting their kind of ancestral village, a Jewish village in Poland, just prior to the start of the Second World War. So that village was basically decimated in the Second World War. So it's this kind of glimpse of something that was destroyed by the Holocaust. And it's very haunting for that reason. But it's only 3 minutes in time, but the film itself is something like 82 minutes or something. So they kind of do really interesting things with zooming in on little details and stretching it out and discussing things and talking about the sort of mystery behind it. So, yeah, I did really appreciate that film. Also, I should say, I am a Londoner married to a Dutch man, so I also kind of appreciate their marital relationship. I feel like I've got something in common with Bianca and Steve in that, on that level as well.
Yeah, what more representation do you want?
Yeah, exactly. It's me. In this country, we're always talking about the Second World War, or certain sections of this country are anyway, or always thinking about it, and it does, whether we know it or not, weigh heavy on a lot of British families in a way that all history does. But it's in the Netherlands, because it was actually occupied by the Nazis, there's a whole different aspect to the way that that history hangs around. And like, I had the opportunity to go to Amsterdam and meet with Steve McQueen and Bianca and be taken on a tour around the city and some of the locations in the film from them. And one of the things that I was saying to them was, it's funny how everyone's granddad, you know, was in the resistance and no one's granddad was fighting with the Nazis, when we know actually statistically it's very different. But because my own family, my husband's family, you know, had a relative who was kidnapped and murdered by the Nazis because he was rumoured to be in the resistance. We don't really know what the truth of that was. But I guess my point is, almost every family in the Netherlands has some kind of very real connection to the Second World War and that period of occupation. And lots of that generation who are still alive will not speak about it because it's so horrendously difficult. So this film is so meaningful to me, and to all of us, really, because all of us are in some way descended from the Second World War.
I mean, Hafa, like, coming from Brazil, I suppose you've got quite a different relationship with it. I mean, were you kind of intrigued to see how Amsterdam has kind of borne the scars of this terrible thing that happened?
Yeah, I was just about to say that for me, who was born and raised and spent my entire life in Brazil, and whose family is literally a mix of Black people from the Northeast and Indigenous people from the center of Brazil, and you have to go quite deep into my family tree to find European blood. It's really interesting to think about this, because I moved to Europe 5 years ago, and I remember walking the campus of Aberdeen University, which is a really old university here in Scotland, and I just stopped for a second, and I had this really odd realization that people, white men, were getting diplomas here before my country was deemed a country, before it was, quote, discovered by the Europeans. People were already getting education and living in this place, and this building was already here. And it was such a physical representation of history and the difference in history between a country like Brazil and a country like Scotland and the UK. And I think since then, when I first started traveling, going to cities like Amsterdam, and I just very recently came back from Rotterdam, which was bombed and rebuilt, the conversations that exist around it, from signage to people who have an understanding of architecture and how things have shaped and changed the way that even how you cross a street or how you get to one place to the other has been changed. So it affects your day-to-day life in a way that I had never experienced until I was a full-grown adult who had moved out of Brazil. And I've been thinking a lot about the conversations that we have around something like the Holocaust, especially because the zone of interest is so high in the public discourse at the moment. And I think there is this hesitation and this trepidation and this fear around responsibility and around lineage that is completely foreign to me, but at the same time affects my understanding of colonization and presence and occupation in ways that are really interesting to think about when it comes to historic parallels. So rewatching Occupy City after being so deep into thinking of the zone of interest, and even just out of Sundance and watching a film like Jesse Eisenberg's A Real Pain, which just premiered at Sundance and is about two Jewish cousins going around Poland and visiting Auschwitz and doing this sort of tourism from a comedic and dramatic sort of point of view, has me thinking about this more than ever, about the way that people occupy physical spaces, sometimes oblivious to the historical and societal weight that such spaces actually have. But yeah, it's been really interesting to think about it.
It's interesting that you brought up this idea of like a family curse being something that could be real. And like, we've got modern day Amsterdam, and you know, then we're hearing about kind of what essentially 2-3 generations before happened. I mean, how do you think the film kind of deals with those parallels of like this a curse in the city still existing, or the ways in which it can be lifted?
Well, this is another film which had me seeing ghosts, put it that way, because like, I think we should talk about the length of the film, the duration of it. You know, it's interesting that this is another film about the Holocaust which draws attention to its own duration in the way that 3 minutes are lengthening, in the opposite way to the 3 minutes lengthening did. But I think it's 4 hours and 22 minutes. Is that right?
Yeah, but he has said there is a 36-hour version.
There's a 36-hour version, which, you know, may get exhibited in a gallery at some point, but probably not in a cinema, maybe. So, but it's an unusually long film, even in our era of unusually long films. And it also has a intermission, which is quite unusual in this day and age. And I think that's significant as well. And I think it's important. It's not just that it's warranted by the material, but I think the duration is necessary. It's what enables it to become this kind of transcendent audiovisual time-travelling experience, as opposed to just another trip to the cinema, for a couple of reasons. One is that it's the only way to even begin to convey the overwhelming vastness of the horror and tragedy of the Holocaust and the war. There's so many stories. Like, you are just overwhelmed by, as what, when you're watching it, by each one of these stories contains enough humanity and tragedy and horror and betrayal to be its own kind of Oscar-winning Hollywood movie if someone just decided to pick up on it and dramatize it in that way. And there's hundreds of them, and that's not all of it either. They could have made, as you say, there's a 36-hour film in there, and I'm sure it could have been longer. And then the second reason that duration is so important is, for me, the most interesting one, actually. It's because it does something very unusual. The having in your brain, when you're seeing the images from the contemporary city juxtaposed with the audio, which is this British Jewish woman, Melanie Hyams, in the English language version anyway, essentially very, quite fairly deadpan narrating the contents of Bianca Stigter's book about what happened at these addresses during the war. That kind of disconnect combined over the duration of the film, so that you're inevitably, your brain's wandering and coming back and bringing details from your own life, and you're thinking about, you know, your shopping list, or you're thinking about what you were looking at on your phone in the intermission, which in my case was more news of bombings in Gaza. And it's all kind of melding together into this to induce this very unusual, I think, in a cinema mental state, something that I've only ever experienced in other really long films like slow cinema, like Jean Dielman, for instance. It's almost like your brain starts projecting the visuals to match the audio onto the screen that you're seeing. So I felt like I was seeing the ghosts of the resistance fighters, or, you know, the Nazis walking down, you know, the street again. And I don't mean to overstate it, but it is that powerful, I think. That it's very, very simple in a way, the juxtaposition of the different audio and visuals. But I think the impact it has is really, really special.
Yeah, I think it will be an entirely different experience depending what it is that you kind of personally bring to it, the parallels that you draw yourself. For me, because, you know, my hometown of Khartoum, Sudan, is like currently being occupied, like, it really just struck me watching it, like the idea that, like, so many, there's just been a mass exodus from that city, and it's like horrifically violent and war going on every day. But the idea of like this, a future city without us, as this city of Amsterdam went on without these people and their descendants who should rightfully be there was a lot.
I think another thing as well, I was reading some of the reviews and Peter Bradshaw said something that is quite interesting when he said the idea that this is in 4K and you're seeing people walk around in modern living times, just has this realization that when this happened many decades ago, it looked to the people living like the film looks just right now. And I think for me, who don't have really a touching point of the past and only thinks of this happening through archival footage and people who I probably would have never met in any sort of situation, it really brings it home in an eerie way that this was happening in modern time, in colour, with living people who had preoccupations that were off their time. And he's so clever the way that he's just walking around the city that is living and breathing and existing at this point in time, as he has once before. It's very effective, and I haven't been able to stop thinking about it. I was very lucky to see Sunshine State in Rotterdam last year, which is his latest exhibition. And there was also, well, installation. And there was also this notion of lulling narration and juxtaposed images that just draw you in, and this idea of repetition and hammering these notions in your head slowly until you're almost taken out of the work and forced to think about your life and the things that are happening in your life, because there's no engagement, active engagement in new information. So you're existing in these two spaces, which is a very powerful narrative tool for a film. Like, narrative tool sounds simplistic, but it is really incredible the way that it happens in Occupy City.
It's sort of an extraordinary step into empathy that he sort of forces you to do, I think. And in a way that sort of, you know, having read a bit of Bianca's book, like, he's asking you to see these things as like true, fully rounded, precious human lives, each one that ends in an awful tragedy, in a way that you hear stories in the book where there's one where there's a diary entry where somebody says, oh yes, I looked out of my window today and, you know, all those poor Jewish people being, you know, rounded up. But it's all right because we went out to the woods and we picked strawberries and I had a good night's sleep. And so, like, I'm actually in a pretty good mood. And it's like, that's the exact thing that McQueen won't allow you to do.
Very zone of interest, that diary entry.
Yeah.
This is heavy. Like, I don't want to put people off seeing, because it's not totally, somehow, and this is again his testament to his genius, it isn't completely like heavy or dirgy or anything like that. Like, and I totally take your point, Hafa, about the sort of there but for the grace of God, that it, the reminder to those of us who have spent all of our lives in like on Western European cities, post-war Western European cities, where the idea of bombardment seems very far away. I mean, I grew up in the East End, which was heavily bombarded during the Second World War. But I think for a lot of people, it's a kind of, that's something that happens in other countries, right? Obviously not for you, Layla. So for a film to be reminding us that actually, no, this could happen to people just like you, with families just like your family, and it did happen, and it might happen again, and it is happening right now, is very powerful. But also the sort of moments of joy and humour that you just can't deny. Like, there's a story there that which I love about the resistance kind of stealing a Nazi seaplane, flying it all the way over from Amsterdam to Broadstairs, and they had to like cover up the they were getting shot at by the British soldiers, obviously, because it had a big swastika on the side of the plane. So they had to lean out of the plane midair and like cover it up with a kind of orange flag or a peace flag or something. And then somehow like landed on the beach at Broadstairs, which I've been to Broadstairs many times, never heard that before, just a wild story. And then, and the final shot of these kids like bursting joyously forth out of these beautiful gold doors of a synagogue after a bar mitzvah. There were these sort of moments that, like, you know, there's a kind of joy in, even in the fact that, like, yes, we are kind of oblivious sometimes, like life does go on, like we don't know what happened in these streets and in these houses before us. And there's like, I like the way that the film kind of asserts that not only is that okay, but in some way it is also a way of honouring the dead to go on living.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I want to make sure that everyone goes and watches if they can. I think it's just this weird intersection of time where I'm thinking about this film and thinking of Jonathan Glazer and thinking about what has happened in the world that puts you in a odd mindset, but you just brought up the closing scene there, and spoiler alert, although is it even, but it ends in a way that is very beautifully hopeful, and I think Bianca and Steve have been very open that they're raising their kids there. They're seeing their kids make new friends and create new life and new stories. And I think that's quite beautiful and quite a beautiful byproduct of having partners work together, life partners work together as well.
Well, we should get some scores on this, even though I think I could talk about this for 4 hours and 20 minutes. Ellen, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
I think it's going to be a 5-5-5. Even though, I didn't know what to expect, I Steve McQueen is just one of the best. And the experience, I wish I could give it higher than a 5 score for the experience itself, because it's unlike any other experience I've had in the cinema before. And as I say, like, truly transcendent. And then, yeah, as you say, could be talking about this film for hours and hours and hours. So definitely another 5 in retrospect as well.
Not to seem like I'm copying your homework, but 5-5-5. I don't think Steve McQueen has made a film that isn't 5-5-5. Hapa, what about you?
Say, I think to me it's exactly the same. I love Steve McQueen. I have loved everything that Steve McQueen has ever did. I feel very privileged to live at a time where he's allowed to make such incredible and varied work and excel such different fields.
Will he make a film with Zac Efron though? When?
Oh my god. You guys who have
making a film with Harris Dickinson, so we're only one step removed.
You guys who have ties to him, if you can make this happen, that would mean a lot to me actually. So I do think I'm also on the 5-5-5 train. I think I've now watched this film twice, so I spent 9 hours of my life in that space, and I don't think I have ever before in my life rewatched a film that was so long and demanding in ways in such a short space of time. But I just found myself thinking of it again and wanting to exist in that space again, and understanding how Steve and Bianca kind of visualize that format, that to me it seems so simple when you tell people these are images and someone is telling you about these images, and it seems so simple and it seems like it's been done thousands of times again, and at the same time it feels like I've seen something that has never been done before, and I don't think this comes along very often. So yes, that's incredible. 5-5-5.
I mean, even though some of his subject matters are heavy, I do feel very lucky to be alive at the same time that Steve McQueen is making work. But yeah, we should move on, well, kind of leave the Holocaust and go back to the world of wrestling. For Film Club, it's The Wrestler. The Wrestler stars Mickey Rourke as an aging professional wrestler who, despite his failing health and waning fame, continues to wrestle and attempt to cling to his success of his 1980s heyday. So, yeah, Hapa, I mean, even just saying that, in some ways, this feels a bit like a dark sequel to The Iron Claw, where it's just like, you know, this is almost like the terrible next chapter that could happen for the 80s wrestler if they survive the 80s.
Yeah, I'm wondering if anyone who's listening to this right now can send us uplifting wrestling films. Like just fun, joyful, no trauma, just people putting on silly costumes. I love The Wrestler. This is a film I hadn't seen it in many years, actually. And it is so good. I mean, I'm in a point with Adam Aronofsky where I just don't trust him. I feel very tentative going into anything that he has a hand on.
Was that point reached when Brendan Fraser lifted off into the sky? Was that the exact moment that you came to that point?
That was my trust on Darren Aronofsky also leaving my body. I mean,
well, something that Aubrey Gordon referenced a little earlier on, but you haven't had the interview.
It gave me a sense of whiplash to rewatch this film and realize how good he can be and how interesting a storyteller he can be. And at the same time, the casting on this film, this is incredible. Mickey Rourke, I know we're going back to 2008 Oscar discourse, but it is truly, truly staggering how great he is in this. And then at the same time, Marisa Tomei, who's one of my favorites, and she's so sexy in a way that makes you feel that it is impossible for anyone to be that sexy and commanding and incredible, but at the same time, so sad and so foreign and full of responsibility.
responsibilities, and it's such a hard line to walk. And think of this 16 years ago now, before so many films that have explored the same sort of dichotomy and in sex work and in ways that have been so beautiful, that she has done this 16 years ago is incredible. I think everything in this film is great. Cinematography is great. I think costume design is great. I think the actors obviously are really outstanding. And that final scene, I have this thing where I watch a film and there's a final cut, and if it's at the perfect moment, I get this insane frenzy. They're like, oh my God, I cannot believe this just happened. This man just cut exactly where I think he should cut. And this is one of those films, whenever I think this is perfect, an ending, I think this is it. So I'm quite re-energized that we are talking about The Wrestler now, because I think it is truly a great film. You can watch it with your dad. You can watch it with your husband who doesn't like films. You can watch it with your friends. It is really that good.
Have you also, though, Mandela affected that Mickey Rourke did win the Oscar for this?
Yes.
I'm always shocked when I learn that he didn't. And it's happened like 12 times. It's just my brain refuses to accept.
Who did win that year?
I'm literally just Googling this.
If you have to Google, then it was just Mickey Rourke. We'll just rewrite history. Yeah.
Let's do this right now. Let's make this fact. Oh, Daniel Day-Lewis.
What, for...
Daniel
Plainview. There Will Be Blood. There Will Be Blood, yeah.
Oh, damn it. We can't even be them now.
I do enjoy the parallels between Mickey Rourke being a bit of a washed up actor looking for a comeback, and his character in this film, and it being kind of utilised in the film. In the same way that, I was talking about Zac Efron kind of leveraging or utilising his public persona as a sort of slightly past it, no offence, a teen heartthrob, but to deepen the character roles that he's playing. I like it when films do that, when they kind of acknowledge the public conversation about an actor. I think it's smart. And this is maybe more of a controversial point, but I also like when films make the implicit comparison between sex work, like female sex work, and other types of male gendered, sort of physically, mentally wearing labour, such as wrestling. There's a early Stanley Kubrick film that I was watching recently called Killer's Kiss. I was watching it because it's got a performance from an actor called Frank Silvera, who is a sort of racially ambiguous, and I'm very interested in kind of the history of racially ambiguous performances for my book. I write about it in my book in that context, and also interracial. It's potentially one of the first interracial kisses, although I don't think Stanley Kubrick knew about it. But from this particular point of view, it's got the lead of the film is a boxer, not a wrestler, but there's a really interesting sequence quite early on in the film where Kubrick juxtaposes this boxer walking into his apartment with his opposite neighbour, who is a woman who works as a taxi dancer, which is a kind of period-specific low-level sex work where men would pay you to dance with them in nightclubs and maybe more. And each of their kind of movements are sort of shot in parallel. So it's very obviously inviting you to compare her work and his work, and suggesting that you can respect this as labour and not stigmatise it for sort of old-fashioned misogynistic reasons, while at the same time recognising that it can be very damaging to the body and to the soul to use your body to make a living in this way.
Yeah, and before I add on to this, I just want to correct myself and say that actually, because this film ran on for the 2009 Oscars, Sean Penn won for Milk over Mickey Rourke. And now I am back. I am back on my train of rewriting history. And I think that we can do it. How is this possible?
No, my brain will simply refuse to absorb that information. And I'll think Mickey Rourke won within 10 minutes from now.
Honestly, God, I'm going to send him a letter today saying I am so sorry this was done to you. But yeah, I think everything that Ellen just said is such a fantastic point. And also, it also comes from that understanding of parents who have this desire to do right by their kids, but are so drawn out by life and the consequences and the cards that are dealt to them. And understanding that you will go to whatever circumstances and whatever places that you need to go to provide for your kids and to make sure that they have a different life path, which is in a way the antithesis to this dad of the Iron Claw, of wanting your children to be completely different, to follow completely different pathways than the ones that you have followed, and this desire to safeguard. Yeah, it's truly, truly a great movie.
Mm. But both films have that kind of hard-earned but very beautiful compassion of the child for the parent who has failed ultimately to protect them from, you know, all the degradations of the world, but meant well and tried. And it just had the opposite of that.
Yeah, and I'm just remembering Mickey Rourke prancing in front of Evan Rachel Wood's house, and he has his hands kind of in his pocket, and his lips are so poofy, and he's kind of like, you see him in Dateline, and he looks like this creature. And at the same time, he's just so nervous and trepidant, and this little teenager inside the house has his entire life in her hand. Ah,
yeah, it's an incredible performance, isn't it?
Mickey Rourke! How come?
So we are highly recommending you revisit The Wrestler. But before we go, you guys are going to give me your non-movie recommendations for people who somehow still have time on their hands after they watch these three films. Hafa, do you want to go first? What is your non-movie recommendation?
My non-movie recommendation is Ellen's book. That too.
Why not? Also, that's fine.
That as well. Oh my God. Segue. So Ellen's book and buy yourself an inhaler, a steamer inhaler, this little thing that produces steam, and you put it in your face and you sniff it and it clears out your sinuses. It cost me £20 and it was the best £20 I've spent in recent months. Thank you so much for the people who invented this little steamer machine. So that is my recommendation. It is cold out there. Get your sinuses cleared out.
Yeah, I believe Ellen's book is £25, so, you know.
Not right now. It is reduced. You can get a 10% discount.
Come on, get in. Buy it while it's
get
hot.
Get in.
Ellen, what about you? What is your non-movie recommendation?
Well, my non-movie recommendation is my book, Screen Deep, How Film and TV Can Solve Racism and Save the World. But also, I recently saw a new exhibition at the Royal Academy. It's on for a couple of months, so people can have a chance to catch it, even if they're not currently in London. It's called Entangled Pasts, 1768 to Now. And it's all about kind of how colonialism has been an influence on and been reacted to in visual arts, like from that point in history when, you know, the East India Company was very much still a going concern to now when we have more artists of colour who have family histories of resulting from colonialism and responding to the artworks. But the reason I bring it up is because there are loads of movie and TV parallels, including the chance to see the portrait of the Amarasanti's film Belle from 2011 is based on, in the flesh, as it were, which I found really exciting. And also the chance to see Ray Fearon, who I know best as Beris in the TV show Champion, the Candice Carty-Williams show about a family of British Jamaican musicians. He's playing Frederick Douglass, the great emancipated slave-turned abolitionist, in an installation by Isaac Julian, a.k.a. one of only three black British filmmakers to have a film released in the entirety of the 1990s, who made a film called Young Soul Rebels. And you know, to bring it back to our favourite Steve McQueen, is one of these kind of visual artists who has made the move into filmmaking as well and then gone back again. So, yeah, really great exhibition. So much in there. Lots of interesting parallels. It's a good one to go and see if you're reading my book at the same time.
Oh, my God, Ellen, I was here. Go get your sinuses clear. And you're like, colonization.
I'm nothing if not a broken record.
No, that's great. I wish I was in London to see it.
Thanks very much. Yeah, that's just reminding me probably of like the greatest exhibition day that I ever had was I went on an American history tour of Washington, and you start at Frederick Douglass's house and you saw all these different things and you kind of see the White House and you kind of, the incredible man was explaining to us about like the role of slavery in the building of the White House and its maintenance. And then you end up at the African American Museum, where you then start with slavery at the bottom. And as you go up and up, you sort of work your way into like more modern times, and you end with Beyonce.
Hey!
Oh, that's so beautiful.
It was so beautiful. I think it's one of the best days of my entire life. So if you're in Washington, do that. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next time we'll be talking Wim Wenders Perfect Days, Olivia Colman's new comedy Wicked Little Letters, hearing about the highlights from the Berlin Film Festival, as well as an interview with the wonderful Juliette Binoche. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Hafa Sams Ross and Ellen E. Jones. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.